on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
What's so important to you right now, not in the long run, is, you know, or in retrospect, is not important at all.
Right.
And so these kind of emotional things, these triggers, are there, you know, they're there biologically because they are triggering you for something that you need to pay attention to. But don't become so self-absorbed and wrapped up into them that they become, you know, they go beyond signaling devices into something that, you know, that we want to make real and act on. But these emotions are just, as I just said, kind of signaling devices of what's wrong and what's right. And then, you know, and without adding your own personal energy to it, you know, I'm angry because of this. And then, you know, and then your anger gets on top of anger and you spin until you get bent out of shape. And then you say things that you might regret or do things you might regret. And you just let it build. So anger, you know, is a signal something's wrong. But don't pursue the anger as an you know, as an end in itself, you know.
Right. Yeah.
All right. What's wrong? What can you rationally do about it?
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth.
I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I'm joined by Clint Seidel, the founder and former director of Cornell University's Roy H. Park Leadership Fellows Program and longtime Buddhist practitioner, to discuss his book, Vipassana Meditation and Ayahuasca. Clint details the transformative experiences he had with ayahuasca, explaining how they dovetailed with his Buddhist practice. He emphasizes ayahuasca as a temporary skillful means for spiritual awakening, aiding but not replacing the practice of Buddhism. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Clint Seidel is the former and founding director of the Roy H. Park Leadership Fellows Program at Cornell University's Johnson Graduate School of Management, where his leadership programs are nationally recognized. He is a longtime Buddhist practitioner and the author of several books, including The Leadership Wheel. He joins me today to discuss his latest publication, Vipassana Meditation and Ayahuasca. Clint, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
Yeah, I'm looking
for the opportunity.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. I'm looking forward to the conversation. This is your book's a bit of a different book, and I was excited, when I saw this in the publisher's list of forthcoming titles. And in part because I have a background in Buddhism, I used to say that I was a bad Buddhist because I don't belong to a Sangha or have a guru. But someone said, no, just call yourself a secular Buddhist. And I have some experience with the medicine. And so I was really intrigued by the two of these working together. So I thought that the place to begin would be with your journey. You've been practicing Buddhism before you experienced the medicine. So I thought that I would ask you a bit of your background, your personal journey in Buddhism.
Okay. It goes back a long way. I was in a Peace Corps in Nepal back in 78 and 79. And one of the reasons I ended up in Nepal as opposed to other places that the Peace Corps offered to me was a, you know, kind of innate interest in the spiritual traditions of the East. And I wasn't long into the Peace Corps experience before I met somebody who told me about S.N. Goenka and a Vipassana meditation course, 10-day meditation course that he taught in India, in Igapuri, outside of Mumbai. And so off I went. And this was in 1979, and it was a silent 10-day Vipassana retreat. And I swear, two things. One, I was so high that when it got to be about day 10, I was so high in the experience, I swore that I only needed a couple more days before I reached full enlightenment. Of course, that was a total delusion at the time, but I was so blissed out that was my experience. And the other thing that I noticed is that when I finally did start speaking, I had vertigo from the reverberation of the sound on my eardrums, and that was quite nice. So it was really, really silent. And that was January of 1979, and I've attended. I've been in retreat at least once a year ever since. First in Vipassana, and then I graduated or moved on to more the Tibetan style
Okay.
of meditation.
All right. Can I ask you where you were in Nepal?
Nepal.
Yeah.
Oh, where in Nepal?
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
I was in Kathmandu and Bharatnagar.
Okay. All right. Yeah,
From
I've been
some
to
of my
Nepal
Far East.
three. Yeah, I've been to Nepal 3 times.
Oh, you have?
Mostly just around Kathmandu.
Yeah,
But
Kathmandu, especially Bodh,
yeah.
where the
Oh yeah.
Tibetan center is and the big stupa. I returned since. I have led some Cornell University alumni on treks there 5 or 6 years in a row.
Okay.
And it was a
Wonderful.
kind of my interest in the trek was just to introduce people not only to Nepal, but to actually begin to beg what their own spiritual beliefs were. And it worked, I think, for the time that I did it.
Yeah, interesting, interesting. Yeah, the last time I was there, I stayed at a Buddhist monastery at the guest house right by Bodhnath. Yeah, so I would like to go back. I am curious how things might have changed after the massive earthquake a few years back.
I was there last, right after the earthquake, and there were a lot of buildings there that we weren't allowed to go into because they were no longer structurally sound. But a lot of change since then. I have a friend who just went to Bodh and Kathmandu, and things seemed to be. She was there for a meditation retreat and a meeting her lama. Sounds like things are back together again.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah, I have a couple of friends that there's a shared social media site that we have from a retreat that I had been on. And a couple of weeks ago, they just began posting these pictures from, and I'm like, that's Bodhnath. That's Kathmandu. That's Swayambhu. And I had no idea they were going, but yeah, it's a magical place. It's a wonderful
It
place.
truly is. It truly is.
Yeah. So you got this background in Buddhism, and you've been practicing since about 1979. What led you to ayahuasca?
Oh, so I practice in the Hinayana Vipassana tradition for, I forget, something like 15, 17 years. It got a little stale. I started experimenting again in my, with different spiritual traditions, and I had a kind of 3 or 4 year experience with Native American traditions, which I to this day I cherish. Before I met my Tibetan Buddhist lamas, I actually think that my Native American experience in a way prepped me for this. And there are three lamas altogether, all in the same kind of lineage. And are actually just their centers are just about 30 miles apart in the Catskills in upstate New York. And so I was with them for 10, 15 years. And then in 2011, two of the three passed away within 6 months of each other. And I was suddenly feeling lost and I began to drift. And at the time, I was working, leading these treks. Working in leadership development at teaching leadership development at Cornell, and there were opportunities to lead treks to Nepal, and then a couple of people had been on a trek twice and said, "Let's do something different. Let's go to Peru." So I had no clue about Peru, so I took a scouting trip to Peru, and I grew fascinated by the indigenous traditions and the spiritual traditions and the geography and so on and so forth. I said, my goodness, this feels a lot like Nepal, but in the opposite side of the earth, almost literally, which a much more indigenous culture. And so I came back and I started, after this week-long exploratory trip for treks, came back and I started reading everything I could about Peru and soon came across this thing called ayahuasca. I said, what the heck is this? And I said, that looks like something that could help me out of my doldrums, out of my spiritual funk after having lost two of my three lamas. And so I did my research and went off in a remote area in Peru and had my first experience with ayahuasca. It was mixed, mostly because I didn't connect with the the shaman, the curandero. And but I felt its power. So I came back, and having led a trek to Peru, I had some guides who were familiar with all of this, and so I asked their opinion, and they pointed me to a shaman named Alonzo Del Rio, who is in the Sacred Valley, and I met Alonzo. He speaks a little English and much in common, about the same age, and I really connected with him. And so over the course of 3 years, I think I had 20 plus journeys with him. I think I went to Peru six or seven times. He would do one or two ceremonies a week, and I would practice meditation in between and hang out. And so they were my retreats at that period of time, or for that period of time. So that was my experience. But towards the end, and we can get more into what my experience was, but towards the end, I always refer to the experience in the feminine. It was just automatic. I didn't think about it. So when I had conversations, it was with her. And so in the end, she said, "We're done. We're done." I said, "What? We're done." And so 3 times in a row, three ceremonies in a row, she said, "We're done, we're done. You have what you came to learn. I have given you what you needed. Now it is time for you to return to your path, to your true path," which is the Buddhist thing. So that's what I did. And that was in 2017 or 18. I can't remember exactly which year. And I haven't ventured towards her since. And I actually ha don't have a desire. I mean, if it popped in my lap, but it's gone. And it was beautiful.
Yeah, it's probably wise to listen to Mother Ayahuasca if she tells you we're done.
We're done. We're done. We're done. Yeah.
Now, as you were working with the medicine, did your experiences with Buddhism, how did you, were there connections that you were making while you were working with the medicine? Did that occur later with reflection? How did those two work together for you?
I experimented early on with meditation in ceremony when, the world was being turned upside down. And I said, "Now this is mixing apples and oranges. I mean, do one or the other." And my experience with her was, through the holograms that you see and the different experiences that I had, she showed me true emptiness. So there's a connection there between Buddhism and emptiness and ayahuasca. At one point, I was with Alonzo, and these ceremonies would usually last 4 hours, and that is usually the duration of the impact of the medicine. But I would always go on for double that amount of time, sometimes even more. Even when I was doing LSD when I was younger, I was always highly sensitive to the medicine. And so, end of ceremony, everyone's out of the maloka. I'll go back to my cabin. I'm alone in my cabin, and I'm tripping my brains out. It's like 1 a.m. in the morning. So I gotta come down. I gotta come down, and because I'm just going crazy here, and I'm all alone. So I said, "Well, maybe a little water will help me." So I drank the water. I became the water. There was no difference between me and the water. It was really scary. And then I said, "Well, maybe tea will be better. It's got caffeine in it." So I made some tea and made some caffeine. I became the caffeine or the tea. And it was like there was no difference. It's hard to explain. There was no difference between me and the object, subject object, which is very fundamental principle of in Buddhism. And it was like a visceral experience of emptiness and of no self, no self-reference at all. And that was her pointing out instruction to me. And it was after, soon after that, she said, "We were done because you now have what you need. You now have what you need." I literally at 1.2, I mean, I looked at my hand and I could literally see through it.
Wow.
You know, not, you know, I could see the bones, but I could see on the other side, because what this really does, I mean, ayahuasca is not something foreign to the brain. It releases something that's already there in the brain. So it's more of what you already have. And so it was a natural boost of that serotonin or whatever we call it. I was never fond of following up on a scientific or chemical background of all this stuff, but it releases something in your brain, and I guess, it was extremely powerful, extremely powerful. Well, seeing through my hand was crazy.
Yeah, I've never had any kind of the experiences that people often describe, and like what you described with ayahuasca. I don't have the psychedelic effects, it seems. It's really interesting. The one time that I came close to seeing something was the very first retreat I went on, but I was focusing on my breath. And I had this one moment, this one very brief moment where everything fell silent and felt peaceful. And then it was like, oh no, I need to purge. And then
Oh,
that was
yeah.
the, yeah, that was the end of it.
That was the end of it.
And I know it's not the medicine because other people at the retreats during the sharing circles were saying, oh no, I had this experience. I had, snakes going through all my chakras. And I'm like, yeah, not
Yeah.
me.
I had, kind of those funky kind of experiences too. And, early on, I found that, as I said earlier, mixing meditation with the experiences, apples and oranges, and so they don't really mix well. And so I just gave up and went with the experience. And yeah, I could see through my hand. I, see these visuals. I saw a serpent. Oh, I have to share this story because this is like trip number three or four before I started really seeing things, having visions. I don't like to call them hallucinations. They're more kind of visual, kind of real experiences. And I'm again in Peru, and I come back to the Moloka, and I'm still tripping. And I'm alone in my bunk, and I'm underneath a, a mosquito net, a big old white mosquito net. And I'm sitting there on my back, and my arms are crossed, and I'm just staring up at the, up into the mosquito net. And all of a sudden, she appears as a serpent. A big old serpent that she was on my chest, and she, a holographic serpent, and she curled, her head was up and bent down to me, and she said, "What question do you have?" I said, "How do I fall in love again?" And without any forethought, that would just spontaneously came out, and she said, "Through me." And that was like trip number three. And then about 18, I had had that experience of truly falling in love again. It's kind of a derivative of no self. And before she said, "See you later." But yeah, it was powerful.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Yeah, I could see like energy coming off of trees and whatnot.
Yeah.
But it's not all that unusual for me. I'm in a weird kind of world. So in the book, you refer to ayahuasca as a skillful means. In Buddhism, I think the term is upaya. And I was wondering if you could maybe explain a little bit for the audience what skillful means is and how that applies to the ayahuasca experience.
So skillful means are methods and tools to help open you up. They're a little kind of assistance to opening. They are not the end product. They are not the goal. They're just, this is a way, meditation is a way to open you up to your, is a skillful means for self-discovery. Just as ayahuasca is a skillful means for self-discovery. And all skillful means. Again, I regret just saying that meditation as a skillful means, I think that's a mischaracterization because, especially in the kind of meditation that I practice, I'm just simply resting in awareness itself. You know, it's called Dzogchen. And so it's just a kind of a non-doing and just resting in complete wakefulness. And so it's not a method, it's just there, you know, and resting there in theory over time, and no matter what you are doing, you know, it ultimately brings enlightenment, right? But so meditation, especially Dzogchen, I think, you know, if I call it a skillful means, it's a little bit of a misnomer. A better skillful means in Buddhism might be the six paramitas, or the great, you know, the six perfections of generosity, concentration, wisdom. I forget all of them off the top of my head, but
Yeah, I've got them here from your book.
okay, good.
Yeah, so generosity, moral discipline, patience, and then I think you refer to this in two different ways: joyful effort or diligence, concentration, and wisdom.
Yeah, that's it. These are ways of the six parameters are ways of bringing to life practice in your daily life. You know, concentration is something that you need to bring to your daily life in order to stay present in whatever you're doing, whether it's being generous or morality. And morality, you know, is, you know, I have a little bit to say on morality, is that, you know, most spiritual traditions have these lists of do's and don'ts, you know, and I always resisted that. And I resisted it, you know, when I was, as a professional, I resisted it in leadership development too. You know, here are the do's and don'ts. And I said, you know, there are no hard and fast rules. There's no silver bullet that will work every time, except for awareness and self-presence. Why? Because it always depends. It depends on you, depends on who you're working with, or it depends on the context that you're within. So you can take those six parameters and, you know, and do they work in all situations, in all processes? Yeah, you know, they can, but they adapt to the situation. So they're not these hard and fast and concrete rules that we, from our own culture, want to hold on to and say, this is it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's generally the Abrahamic traditions that have the rules, you know, the thou
Yeah.
shalt and thou shalt not. But the I'm going to make a connection here because this is sort of my jam. What I kind of studied was there is a connection to what came before all of the rules, which was virtue, the ideas of virtue. And for Aristotle, who I kind of rely on here, I think there is a very clear comparison that can be made between the Aristotle's ideas of virtue and Buddhist ideas of the, you know, the paramitas and the four immeasurables and whatnot. And what the connection I make is that for Aristotle, you become virtuous by practicing virtues. You know, you become honest by practicing honesty. You become wise by practicing wisdom. And you wrote in the book, the path models the result. And it seemed to me that that's very similar to this other idea of how we become moral beings.
Yeah. The path does model. We can behave our way into new ways of being.
Yeah.
There's another way I like to put that. We, you know, often we think that, that meditation, for instance, is a panacea for everything. You know, if you're doing it correctly, then you're automatically compassionate and generous and, you know, and moral and all this other stuff. Yes, you know, that's kind of working from the inside out, but honestly, I don't think it'll ever get you there on its own. So you can work from the inside out or from the outside in, and the outside in is you change your behavior. And in changing behavior, it's linked to your attitude. You know, I used to teach leadership, but, you know, I was pointing out this very same principle to the group. And I said, you know, you ever feel grumpy? Yeah. You ever open a door for somebody when you're feeling grumpy? Yeah. What's it feel like? All of a sudden, I don't feel so grumpy anymore.
Yeah.
You behave your way into a new way of being. Even if you don't feel it, act it. Because a behavior is affects your attitude, just as your attitude affects your behavior.
Yeah.
It goes both ways.
Yeah.
And I don't think many people see that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, when I think about and again, I think this applies to both, the Western Aristotelian kind of perspective, but also with Buddhism, because they seem to have a similar goal, which is happiness. And in the Greek, the word happiness was eudaimonia, which now more scholars are translating as flourishing, that you want to be virtuous so that you can flourish. But if you look at the etymology of the word, it literally means something like a good spiritedness. And so I was making that connection as you were just speaking, that, holding open the door for someone and doing these practices, it always gave me the sense of having my spirit was just lighter.
And the interesting thing is that as your spirit is lighter, or as it, comes into being more kind of in the realm of your awareness, it's an open-heartedness too. It's not just
Yeah.
wakefulness.
Right.
It's also open-heartedness, and I think this is one of the things that you in your email had wanted me to talk about is that, when it boils down to it, what is the stuff that we are made of? What's the starting point? What is the ground, so to speak,
Right.
of our being? Aside from all these behaviors that kind of manifest and, habits of the mind and so on and so forth. I mean, if you drill down, what is the root? And in my ayahuasca experience, and over and over again in Buddhism, it's awareness and compassion.
Right.
That's the stuff of which we are made. It really, really is. And that's the stuff that, on a spiritual path, if you're not working with both, then you're not on right path, or there's a misinterpretation of what the traditional teachings are saying, because we need to work both.
Right.
We need to work both.
Yeah. Now, by awareness and compassion, I kind of want to ask, and I'm always asking about, well, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by awareness? Is it just being present, or and also compassion? Because at one point, I'm trying to find in my notes that you made the distinction that compassion from a Buddhist perspective is not, and I think the language you use, it's not like the idiot compassion, that there's something different to it. So I was wondering if you could talk about both of those a little bit.
So awareness is kind of being aware of your thinking and your emotions. And so you're not a slave to them. I remember the first time I was in a Vipassana retreat early in my Vipassana experience. First time I became really aware of an emotion, the instructor would just go on and on and on and on verbally. With instruction when we're supposed to be sitting in silent meditation. It was so irritating to me because I just wanted to sit, and in silence, and because that's what I was used to. And when the anger arose in that meditative environment, I could feel it, see it, taste that kind of energy. I get to almost like, almost a visual. And when you see it like that from the inside as the rising, it disappears. It loses its power, its grip, and you go right back to peace. And so that's one of, It's empty, you know, going back to, you know, what the Buddhists say. It's empty. It's just your energy. It's just an energy. Was that your question?
Yeah, but also the compassion, because you had noted that there was, I think you referred to idiot compassion, which
Idiot
is
compassion.
different than regular compassion.
Idiot compassion is when there's still ego involvement. I'm doing good here, so I'm doing this. So you're
Okay.
reinforcing your ego by saying, you know, by doing good things without really allowing compassion to arise, because you are thinking so much about your due goodness and your own basic goodness that, you know, the act of giving something or opening the door for somebody, you don't experience that feeling of generosity. It's an aspect of compassion. So that's what I mean about the difference.
All right. Well, let's talk about the ego just for a moment, because I know that in some of the, actually in all the ayahuasca retreats I've been to, the ayahuasquero, my ayahuasquero has commented that a lot of people come to the medicine because they want to have this experience of like ego death. And he says, you know, that's not the point, really. And in Buddhism, there's often this idea of killing the ego, but it always seems to me that the ego serves a vital purpose. And so, wouldn't it be more like a transcendence of the ego, the creation of a healthy ego? How would you approach, you know, this idea of the ego and how we deal with it?
You know, we can't function without ego.
Right.
I mean, it's just we can't function. How do we work with the ego? I think, you know, from the Buddhist point of view, this is one of the reasons that emptiness is emphasized, because in the long run, you know, of what import is what's so important to you right now is not in the long run is, you know, or in retrospect, is not important at all.
Right.
It, and so these kind of emotional things, these triggers, are there, you know, they're there biologically because they are triggering you for something that you need to pay attention to. But don't become so self-absorbed and wrapped up into them that they become, you know, they go beyond signaling devices into something that, you know, that we want to make real and act on. But these emotions are just, as I just said, kind of signaling devices of what's wrong and what's right. And then, you know, and without adding your own personal energy to it. You know, I'm angry because of this. And then, you know, and then your anger gets on top of anger and you spin until you get bent out of shape. And then you say things that you might regret or do things you might regret. And you just let it build. So anger, you know, is a signal something's wrong. But don't pursue the anger as as an end in itself, you know,
Right. Yeah.
all right? What's wrong? What can you rationally do about it?
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, making it worse by adding fuel to the fire,
Yeah, which is what we tend
which is what we tend to do.
to do. Yeah.
It's what we tend to do. You
Yeah.
know, it's like, you know, leadership, you know, when it came to anger is, you know, one of our stronger negative emotions. It probably is our strongest negative emotions. And there's no, you know, when you're angry, especially with somebody else, it's hard to be skillful in your interactions with them. And this is something, you know, in teaching leadership, you know, difficult conversations, you know, an argument, a negotiation, or, dealing with a difficult person is one of the skillful means for enacting, you know, what you want to be as a leader. And one of the philosophers I used to draw upon for difficult conversations is Martin Buber. was a Jewish philosopher, and I thou, I thou. He's, most of the time when we get into a difficult conversation, it's I it. You have what I want, you're in the way of what I want, or you're irrelevant to what I want, and that's the way I treat you. As opposed to another divine soul, just like yourself. You want to treat people the way you want to be treated. And that kind of diffuses it. And then there's a whole language, in addition to the energy that you may need to manage in a difficult conversation, the whole language that goes with it. The root is, if you cannot manage your emotions in a difficult conversation, no matter how skillful you are with your words, it's going to bleed through, and affect the conversation. So it's really an important aspect, often overlooked in most of the difficult conversation trainings that I've been to or witnessed.
One of the lessons that I learned, and I learned this during my very first ayahuasca retreat, is that I had this idea, and I think a lot of people have this notion that the medicine is kind of a one and done deal. I remember wondering before attending my retreat, I would hear people saying, "Oh, yes, I've gone to, 20, 50, 100 ayahuasca ceremonies." And I was like, "Why?" And I was considering it this sort of magic bullet. And I learned very quickly that is not what it is. And something that my ayahuascaro says, two things is one, you are the medicine. And that's something that you noted in the book. You said, she is me.
Yeah, she is me. And if you're doing 100 sessions, what are you doing? I mean, the important thing for me, and I emphasize this in the book, is you come in with an intention. What do you want to learn? What question do you have? Like going back to the beginning of our conversation, what question do you have? And if you don't, you just wander. Like your thoughts wander in a day. Unless you have a strong intention, she cannot help you. And that's why, I had a 3-year experience. I did 24 ceremonies, and I had an intention each time. And when we were done, we were done. I got what I needed, and she's not addictive, so it's not like you're doing something that's potentially health danger to your health. But unless you have an intention, a clear intention, you're wasting your time.
And there are some things I'm trying to connect here. So the other part of, you are the medicine. The other thing that my ayahuascaro has said is that the ceremony never ends. And I thought about that and I felt that that was where your book in particular was incredibly valuable because there's still work to do. And I think that Buddhism gives us a way to do that work to, in a sense, continue the ceremony.
Yeah, it goes back to the first part of our conversation, and skillful means. Poof! You wake up, have this experience. Your life is much bigger on the outside of your normal box than you normally think it is. And that's the power of her. That's what she does for you. She wakes you up and expands your perspective. But she is not a tool to keep you going. She's not a, she's a temporary skillful means. And that's where something like Buddhism comes in handy. I mean, because it is a perfect complement, I think they are. And I know a lot of Buddhists who would, probably object to my espousing the use of ayahuasca, but hey, I'm going on my own experience. She helped me a lot in my Buddhism. So it's a kind of the frame of mind and your intention that you bring to it. In terms of tapping the full value of the experience.
Yeah, I know that in Buddhist practice, there's a precept, and I forget exactly how it's worded, but it's to avoid anything that scrambles the mind or something like that. So, avoid alcohol and things like that. And some take that to mean also to avoid psychedelics. But you point out that there are records of Buddhists using entheogens in the practice and as a medicine to help them at, as a skillful means.
Yeah. No, there is. I mean, Datura is what I mentioned in the book, and there's plenty of history of that in the Buddhist tradition. The thing is, and it's a skillful means for kind of getting you outside of your box, so to speak. Cracking your cosmic egg is another way I like to say it. That's her value, but she is not a path in and of herself. She's a skillful means. She's a temporary aid to get you out of your box, and she's not addictive, which is I think important for people to realize. I actually asked permission from one of my lamas to use ayahuasca. He advised me just a short period of time, and it went on for 24 times in 3 years, but when it was done, it was done.
And Mother Ayahuasca made it clear when it was done,
And
as you
she made
said.
it clear, yeah.
Now, have you talked to this llama? I mean, is the llama familiar with the experiences that you had? I'm curious what kind of reflections they may have after you've gone on this journey.
I have a few lamas, and they know I did the experience, but I didn't really share with them other than, it's just like they say in Buddhism, everything is empty. That was my big takeaways of ayahuasca. And the other thing that was, and I mentioned this in the book, and it's a subtle thing. That, in every tradition, I don't care if it's Buddhist or Hindu or Christian or Judaic or whatever, the thing we're trying to do is wake up and be compassionate. Awareness and compassion are kind of the roots to all and every path. And the thing that I realize in my ayahuasca experience is that the compassionate part is not necessarily automatic. Not an automatic outcome of increasing awareness. And so you can, for instance, in your in Buddhism, we practice self-awareness through our meditation, and we talk about compassion, and we just think the two go together. And then you walk off the cushion, you're automatically compassionate. You are for a short period of time, but the compassionate part, and it really is the more powerful piece, I think, between compassion. And sorry, I just had a quick call from my grandson. But compassion is the true ego killer. Is the true ego killer, And there are mystics, for instance, who can develop all sorts of powerful kinds of clairvoyant capacities and so on and so forth, and not really be totally realized because they're missing the compassionate piece. Because what are we doing this for? If not to help others.
Well, and it also seems to me that another connection here is with, we have to work on the compassion, but also enlightenment itself. It seems to me that that is something that, I'm always curious about, well, what do we even mean by that? But it seems like a lot of people approach it as it is, as if it is a one and done deal, kind of how I approached ayahuasca at first. Like, this is the magic bullet that's going to clear me up and cure me and make me good and whatever. But it seems like enlightenment, whatever that is something that also has to be worked on a regular basis. It is not something that is just, I'm awake now.
No, it's not. And whether I had my blissful moments with her. I've had in ceremony, and I've had blissful moments on a cushion too in meditation, but they quickly disappear. And this is why we continue to practice to make that realization become more of a habit. It's never one and done. It's life forming and life shaping through extended practice. And so it might feel good for a short period of time, but sooner or later you're back to your, kind of judgmental, grumpy self or whatever, wrapped up in your old ways of relating to people as it's as opposed to other people, so to speak, as an object to be manipulated.
The ceremony never ends.
The ceremony never ends. I mean that, and this is why, whether in Buddhism or in ayahuasca, any serious spiritual tradition, here are these guiding things, principles in Buddhist case, the six paramitas he wants you to practice off the cushion. Bring it to life in your daily life because you're not going to be on the cushion all the time. And for a long time, I wanted to go on to go into one of these long, long retreats of that they offer in Buddhism, 3 years or plus or so on and so forth. But I think we as Westerners have to be really careful with a long-term retreat like that because that's a thing in the East for people who have cultivated this, from a very young age as practice. And then to do a deep dive as a Westerner without the background that the Easterners have, sometimes it doesn't work. It doesn't work. Because you need to relate to people too in your practice.
And I know we're getting towards the end here, but I do have a couple of other questions for you. Along that line, it seems that, with my experiences with the medicine, and I am very grateful for the ayahuasca that I found, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of emphasis on giving like help, suggestions, guidelines on what to do after leaving the retreat. It's just like, well, the medicine never ends. The ceremony never ends. You are the medicine. You still have to do the work. And it seems like, what you've provided is an essential key to doing that work. And maybe it's not for everybody, but I would really like to see, since ayahuasca is becoming more and more prevalent and popular, it would be nice if there was this sort of communication with Buddhism, maybe with other traditions as well, as to how to continue to do the work.
I think it's really important and something, that's pervasive across spiritual traditions. Is what do you do when you're outside the experience and what do you do off the cushion? And in Buddhism, there are these six paramitas that are taught in most sessions, but are never really experienced. And that's something that I wanted to address. So for each of the six paramitas, I have a little story that goes along with it and how this is important and how you can integrate and as an example this into your daily life. And because without the support of something like the six paramitas, whatever you experienced on the cushion, this morning is going to be very short-lived, as you progress during your day, unless you have these other kind of supports in mind.
And you gave some really helpful, because you teach Vipassana meditation,
Yes.
and you gave some really good directions, but you also noted that it would be really important to find an actual teacher or guru.
Vipassana can become a little mechanical. This is something controversial in a Buddhist tradition, a Tibetan Buddhist tradition, is this idea of devotion. Of a lama in your life. And myself, I was resistant to that in the beginning. But it's not like you are blindly devoted. Devotion is a vehicle, is a skillful means for opening your heart. It's another skillful moment, means for opening your heart and just surrendering, so to speak, which is, an aspect of surrender is necessary, to get outside of your box, your habitual ways of being. And it's not only intellectual, it's also heart. Awareness and compassion are two things that I emphasize, throughout the book. So some level of devotion is important. When I first was introduced to this, I said, I can't devotion to a stranger. I don't know. I just met this mama. How's this work? And blah blah blah. And so I'm trying to figure this out on my own. And I remember, I always a big fan of Jesus. Even as a little boy, I was reading the Gospels, and so I said, instead of using the llama as my object of devotion, I'll just use Jesus. And I shared this with one of my llamas, and I said, that's being very skillful, he said. Because what's important is not the object of devotion. What's important is the devotion, the feeling of devotion. Is a skillful means for opening.
I think that both, I always say that I applaud anyone who is working in healing because we need to heal a lot. And it's nice to see healing traditions, conversations happening between healing modalities, like with ayahuasca and Buddhism. And I don't know that we have that conversation enough. So I think it's a really crucial conversation to have.
It is, and I think it's still a new area of discovery. I think that's one reason my book was scooped up so quickly. I was anticipating this long process, and it was picked up within 8 hours. 8 hours. I
That's
published other books
unusual.
before. I published other books before, and it's been, months, not years before something was picked up. But anyway,
Well, interesting.
I think it's timely. It's timely.
Yeah, I
And,
agree.
also, because Oscar is becoming more and more popular in the Northern Hemisphere, and to point out that is not an end in itself. It's a skillful means. It's an aid for help for serious practitioners. And
No,
it's
I agree. Yeah, I agree. So I know that we are at the end of the hour. So let me ask you the final two questions I always ask. And that is, what are you working on next? What do you have coming up? And is there a place where people can go to find out more about you and your work?
So the latter is where you can find about me and my work and my activities is a web page that is just going up, clintseidel.com. No gaps or no spaces. I am teaching Vipassana for Namgyal Monastery here in Ithaca, my hometown, this spring. I teach ayahuasca for, or not ayahuasca, Vipassana for youth at Padma Sambhaling, my home Buddhist center in the Catskills. And I hope to do more of both, especially with the book coming out at this point in time, as another way of sharing what, I personally have learned.
Well, I found the book really interesting and I think very helpful. And as I just said recently, I think that it begins a conversation that is needed. It's very needed, I think.
And never ending.
For sure, for sure. Well, Clint, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank
I
you.
really appreciate it. I enjoyed the
Thanks.
conversation. I enjoyed the book. I will put links for the book and your website in the show notes and video description.
Okay, great. All right, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. And that's a wrap on episode 179 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're a part of my YouTube audience. Now, my longtime listeners know what's coming up next. All the usual. sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family and on social media too, please, and subscribe to or follow the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. I know you know the drill, but the thing is, all of that is really important. Sharing, subscribing, or following, these are all free, and it only takes a few seconds of your time, and they really do help. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's very, very slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship to a living earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may it be at peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.